beings thank you for your loving kindness. So why don't we see if there are any questions or comments, anything you'd like to talk about, either from your experience or anything I said, or anything you're thinking about. And if so, we'll then break for lunch and come back in the afternoon. I'll finish the model of the near and far enemies and with sympathetic joy and equanimity itself. So do you have anything you'd like to ask or comment? There's the man with the microphone.
I just wanted to say a little bit about how you approach people with whom you might be angry or disappointed or upset in the style of life. I understood that this was a process of transformation that was possible in the practice. And I wanted to talk a bit about at what point you introduce.
Well, you know, as I said, that middle portion between oneself and all beings is really very flexible. The classic sequence is oneself, a benefactor, a friend, a neutral person, a difficult person, and then the extension of loving kindness to all beings. And even with the difficult person, one of the underlying principles is said to be a suggestion that we not choose the most difficult person in our entire lives, the one who has harmed us the most, or the one that has behaved just so horribly on the world stage that it's almost unimaginable. Not choose them right away. Doesn't mean never choose them. But the whole process is one of, first of all, building confidence in the power of loving kindness, and also building clarity, because these are very murky waters. You know, what does it mean to have compassion for someone and yet not give in? You know, what does it mean to have a balance of compassion for them and oneself? What does it mean to have compassion and also that recognition that we're not in control? You know, there's a lot of discovery along the way, and we fall into, you know, lots of sorrow maybe, or regret. All kinds of things come up as we're refining that understanding and that confidence. And yet I also have seen that, both in my own mind and with many people, I didn't really like that instruction of choosing a mildly difficult person. I thought, it's not going to count until I get right down to this very... And of course the translation in the... you could say the old-fashioned translation is enemy. You know, it's not going to count until I really work with an enemy that I can't stand. And so, and I've seen that many times. You know, I've given that instruction and somebody will raise their hands and say, well, you know, I tried to send Metta to Hitler and it didn't really work. And I think, well, didn't I just say, you know? But something in us seems to like to go to an edge. So that's part of it, you know, is that... And it's not wrong to go to an edge, but don't feel discouraged if you feel overwhelmed. You know, because it's meant to be a kind of gradual unfolding. You also need a good sense of humor at your own mind and your own reactions, even with a mildly difficult person. One of the instructions I got in Burma was... this goes back to what I said about there being a proximate cause or a springboard, a ready springboard for a Brahmavihara state to arise. So the proximate cause for loving kindness to arise is said to be seeing the goodness in someone. If we can see even one little sliver of good in a massive amount of bad behavior, then it's just easier to have that sense of connection rather than complete alienation, like complete otherness. And it's not meant to have us be foolish and try to pretend that that negative isn't maybe significant and consequential. But if we obsess about what's wrong and we go over it and over it and over it and over it, we'll just naturally feel greater and greater distance. Whereas if we can find one good thing about somebody, then there will be It's almost a feeling like then we can then directly and honestly look at what's wrong, but almost like we're side by side, rather than you're way over there. And sometimes we can't. It's just totally unrealistic that we'll find some element of good in somebody. And then the other reflection that comes up, which I mentioned yesterday really, is this reflection that all beings want to be happy. That we all essentially want the same thing, but we can all be so misguided and confused that we just do these incredibly destructive things. So there I was in Burma, and beginning the kind of formal process of learning this practice. And my teacher, Sayadaw Pandita, said, I want you to go back. First he said, you know, I want you to think of the good in people, even people you don't like. And my very first thought was, I'm not going to do that. I thought, that's what stupid people do. They just kind of go around looking for the good in people. I'm not going to do that. And then I thought, I don't even like people who do that. But as I usually tell the story, it was very far from home. It was in a Burmese monastery. And the nature of the teacher-student relationship in a very traditional culture like that is not one where the teacher suggests you do something and you say, I don't feel like it. So I did it. And I had this very interesting experience. I saw it worked in the way it was supposed to work. Not that I just entered this completely gullible, saccharine, horrible state that I'd been afraid of. But I did feel some greater sense of connection, even acknowledging all the difficulty, when I could pay attention to just one good thing. So I thought of somebody when I got to that time of loving kindness to a difficult person. I thought of somebody I really didn't like. I thought his behavior was obnoxious in general and very abrasive and annoying. And I think I was completely right about that. I think it really was. And then I had this memory of this time where I witnessed him do something really lovely for somebody, like a mutual acquaintance. And he did it in the most graceful way so that she didn't feel condescended to, she didn't feel pitied, she didn't feel that slight disdain of like, oh, you know, I'm taking care of you. It was so well done. It was so elegantly done. And I remembered that, and my first thought was, I don't want to think about that. Like, that complicates things. It's easier when I can put him in the all rotten category, you know, and just like shut the door. But life is actually very complicated. As the Dalai Lama, quoting Shanti Davis, says, enemies can become friends, friends can become enemies. Life is very intricate, it's very complicated. So all of which is to say that if you have that interest, if you have that willingness, it's a very powerful place to play. Can you see one good thing about this difficult person? Maybe not. Can you reflect on the universality of the wish to be happy and the universality of our incredible fragility? Can we remember impermanence? The conditions are constantly changing and shifting. Is there a way in which we can offer them, if not, you know, wishing for their happiness, wishing for their freedom from suffering, that they not be so bound to those very actions that cause so much suffering to themselves as well as to others? Sometimes we play, like, depending on what you discover, you know, sometimes people find that their tendency, if they're offering some kind of loving kindness to a difficult person, is to completely overlook themselves and just kind of get subjugated to this other person in their mind. And so we suggest that maybe you hold yourself and this other person together in your mind's eye. And the phrase, in effect, becomes, may we be happy. May we be peaceful. There's lots of ways of playing. The text would say, is there a way you can imagine this person so that it's more conducive to, if not loving kindness, then compassion. Maybe imagining them as a helpless infant, as they once were, so subject to the influence of those around them. Maybe imagining them dying, if they have not yet already died, because in the end, no matter what grudge we hold, no matter how powerful or powerless we feel, it is what happens. You know, and so it's a way of kind of harnessing the ability to be creative. But it can't feel coercive, you know, like I'm a bad person because I can't have loving kindness for this person. Or, you know, it needs to be really that sense of play and creativity and experimentation. Because in the end, we do want to be free of, you know, being so locked into a certain reactive state. It's like in the classical teachings, there's this word, kalesa in Pali. It, again, the old-fashioned translation of that is defilement. So you read a lot of texts which talk about the defilement of greed or hatred or delusion or something like that. And it's a little bit, clearly, it's a little bit of a problematic translation because it sounds so judgmental, like I'm so defiled. You know? The literal translation of it is torment of the mind. And that I think we can get behind, because we know when we are overcome by greed or hatred or just delusion, we are tormented in a way, we and others. So once I was sitting with Sadhu Pandita in Barrie at IMS, and I just got into one of those kind of obsessive loops where I thought of somebody, a different person I had some difficulty with, and I went through the list of his faults. He does this and he does that and he has this problem and he has that tendency, and then the next sitting I'd go through it again, and then the next sitting I'd go through it again. And then one day I said to myself, well, if kalesa means torment of the mind, why am I being tormented by his defilement? Let him be tormented by his defilement. I don't need to be absorbing that, you know, and just like taking it in and going over it and being obsessed by that. So there was a kind of relinquishing there too, of just like noticing our tendency to do that. We want to fix everybody. Or we get filled with this kind of energy when it's really not up to us. And with the greater spaciousness that comes, then there's actually a greater ability to have some tenderness and compassion. You know, so if you are moved to include a difficult person, definitely. You know, it's clearly very powerful and very challenging. Even a mildly difficult person can be surprisingly difficult. But it's very interesting and powerful as long as you feel it's in that spirit of exploration and experimentation. I will also say, as the microphone's going, you know, classically they say the Buddha taught loving kindness meditation is the antidote to fear. And that's a very interesting dynamic at play with difficult people too, is how much of our difficulty might be rooted in our own fear in some way toward them or about ourselves in relation to them. And so making that effort to explore loving kindness practice toward difficult people is sometimes most transforming of our own fear, which is very important in that dynamic. Yeah.
First of all, I just wanted to say thank you for all the teachings you're giving today and yesterday and the magnificent visualizations and things that you've been giving, which have been very helpful.
Thank you.
One of the interesting things I wanted to talk about was when I was, it's very interesting, when I was walking, trying to start having kind of sort of myself and other peace and everything. was trying to question, or question arose by experience, what does that mean? What does that mean for me? What does it mean for me to be happy?
Mm-hmm.
To be really happy, to be really peaceful. And another word that came to mind that you mentioned earlier was authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And again, what does that mean? Sort of question upon question, and going deeper with that. And that was just very interesting for me. I wonder if you have anything to elaborate on that.
Mm-hmm. I think it is very interesting, and I've noticed, certainly in the States, a lot of people don't like that word happy, because it's got some association with what we would call happy-go-lucky, kind of stupid, you know, and like, I'm happy, doesn't matter, I'll just look the other way as a terrible thing goes on, you know, I'm happy, doesn't matter. You know, so many people actually object to that word, and that's fine. It's fine to, you know, find a word or an expression or a phrase that's more consonant with one's understanding or inspiration. But it's also true, both as you described and even without the thinking process, just as a kind of intuitive opening, the phrases change meaning all of the time as they get deeper and deeper and deeper. So when I was in Burma in 1985, the translation that I was offered, actually, of the phrases was something like, may I be free of danger, beginning with oneself and then, you know, others, but may I be free from danger. May I be free from mental suffering. May I be free from physical suffering. May I live with ease, or may I have ease of well-being. So may I be free from danger. May I be free from mental suffering. May I be free from physical suffering. May I live with ease. And it actually, you know, when we got back to the States and I began teaching loving kindness practice, many people felt uncomfortable about repeating a word like danger or suffering, you know, danger or suffering. Although I have to say, I absolutely had a fine time in Burma, and it didn't make a difference. But nonetheless, the resistance isn't that helpful. So anyway, so those were my four phrases. And I really didn't like that last phrase, may I live with ease. I thought, that's petty. You know, that's so trivial, especially compared to the gravitas of the first three, like, may I be free from mental suffering? Like, yeah, that I can go for, but may I live at ease? It's so trivial. But again, you know, there I was in this very traditional context with a teacher, very strong and demanding teacher. And so I just repeated it, and I repeated it, and I repeated it. And one day, it's like something just shifted inside of me, and I thought, our lives are so complicated. The choices and the dilemmas and the crazy moral dilemmas that we find ourselves in, and the, you know, the ethical nuances and the relationships and the shifting and the changing. And I thought, may I live with ease? That's like my favorite phrase. And it can, you know, it can go through a lot. And that's in contrast, actually, to a friend of mine who happens to work in Washington, D.C. in the government, for whom right away that phrase, may I live with ease, was just outstanding. She loved that phrase. And she decided that the choices that she had coming up all had to pass the may I live with ease test. You know, that was her criteria for making the choice. And actually somebody, an artist friend of mine, made me a stamp that said something like, may I live with ease, or may all beings live with ease. And so I lent it to my friend who works in the government, and every once in a while, just for fun, she stamps with it. You know, may all beings live with ease. And so, you know, it's both very personal, and it's really an evolution over time of what these phrases mean. Which is another reason not to, you know, struggle to get them just perfect. in the beginning, because it will change and modify as we go on.
Hi Sharon, I just wanted to ask you about mudita, if you could elaborate on that. Thanks.
So mudita is sympathetic joy. I will talk more about it this afternoon, because I'll talk about the near and far enemies of sympathetic joy and equanimity. Some people actually don't like that translation of sympathetic joy, because the word sympathy is so associated in our minds with compassion. But it is kind of the classical translation, and so I just am used to using it. It really does mean that ability to rejoice in the happiness of others, rather than falling sway to the jealousy or envy that might arise, but it doesn't need to dominate. And we can have a much more balanced and wise recognition that someone else's happiness actually doesn't take anything away from us. So, you know, and I will talk more about it this afternoon. Do the microphones. Yes.
Do you think there's value in finding equanimity in the body?
Finding equanimity in the body?
Yeah, because some might say that in particular, arms and legs, and to a certain extent neck, feel more equanimous than the rest, than a lot of the rest of the body. They don't feel numb, they feel perfectly alive.
If I understand you correctly, I do think there's benefit to finding equanimity in the body as you're describing it, and I think the greatest benefit actually comes from finding equanimity in awareness. Because then we may observe, say, an area of the body that's full of tension, but not feel defined by that tension. You know, we can have some equanimity toward it, which will also help it release. It seems very paradoxical that even as we work perhaps to release tension or to have awareness fill our body so it's much more alive, seems much more alive to us. We can make the effort to do that not from the same perspective of grasping we may be used to and judgment, like, oh no, this is blocked, oh no, this is numb or whatever, you know. But realizing that the ultimate refuge, you could say, or the ultimate perspective from which equanimity is going to arise is awareness itself. You know, it's having a balanced awareness of what's happening. So, my first teacher was Goenka, my first meditation teacher, who emphasized the body scan, which John Kabat-Zinn also does quite a lot, where you just move your attention through your body, paying attention to the different sensations that you might encounter. And his fundamental message was always about equanimity, like maybe your head is throbbing, or maybe you feel nothing in some place, or maybe you feel nice screaming vibrations in another place. But whatever you feel, you seek to have equanimity toward it, because that's what's most onward leading. You know, so I don't know if that makes any sense in terms of... And it reminds me of, you know, the first thing we do in a way in terms of mindfulness, as we are cultivating that equanimity, is to look to see what we might be adding on to a situation and see if we can release those add-ons. So one way of describing that is in a very classical description of this word, again from the Pali language, this word papancha, which I've always liked because it's one of those words that sounds like what it means, I think. It means proliferation. I think it sounds like popcorn, papancha. It means proliferation, or as I heard one of Upandita's translators once describe it as the imperialistic tendency of mind, where something happens and the entire world is taken over. So here's the story I usually tell about that. I was teaching with my friend Joseph somewhere, and Joseph and I were sitting someplace having a cup of tea, and somebody came into the kitchen where we were in a state of some distress, and he said to Joseph, "I just had this terrible experience." So Joseph said, "Well, what happened?" And he said, "I felt all of this tension in my jaw, and I realized what an incredibly uptight person I am and how I always have been and I always will be." And Joseph said, "You mean you felt a lot of tension in your jaw?" And he said, "Yes, and I've never been able to get close to people and it's never going to change." And Joseph said, "You mean you felt a lot of tension in your jaw?" It was so interesting for me, like watching them go back and forth and back and forth. And finally, Joseph said something to him like, "Why are you adding a miserable self-image to a painful experience? It's painful enough to feel all that tension in your jaw, but on top of that, this is what it means about me, this is how it's going to feel tomorrow, this is never going to change. There's a lot added onto it, which makes it that much worse." So sometimes in kind of meditation lingo, we say the first thing we look for is, what are the add-ons? What's being added on to this? It's not to say that everything's going to be smooth and lovely when you take those away, but it'll be better than having this difficulty plus all that anticipation, all that assumption, you know, all that we might add on to it. So that's an important stage in the process as well. You had your hand up forever. You rest in the red jacket in the front seat. And then we'll break for lunch.
Thank you. Hi. I just wanted to ask about repeating the phrases in the next part of the meditation. So I find sometimes it becomes quite a lot of repeating the phrases. And I don't know if it's just enough just to repeat the phrases or if you've got any advice around that.
It might be just enough to repeat the phrases because of my great cautionary feeling about, you know, don't look for a special emotion, don't worry if it's not there, because of my own experience of not having great waves of emotion and yet discovering later the practice was still developing and deepening. So it might actually be okay, but if you can, in the right spirit, again, you know, not feeling, "Oh, I'm doing badly, this is terrible," but just as a kind of play. But yeah, there are things we can do. You might slow down the phrases and try to aim more distinctly toward one phrase at a time with your awareness, so it's not just a kind of mindless song. You might try to get a clearer sense of the recipient of the metta, maybe visually, if that works for you, or even just a feeling. That's why, you know, you might say their name, you might feel them as though they were sitting in front of you, and then offer the loving kindness, things like that. So it can come more alive in that way.